Hello, Champions Club members. Welcome to part 6 of Midland National's amazing audio series on characteristics of greatness. This is Jerry Blair, Chief Distribution Officer at Midland National. It is our goal to make sure that you know you're not just a member of Samlyn's Financial Group. You're part of the Midland National family that cares about you as well as your personal and professional development. To prove it to you, we enlisted the help of 9-time New York Times best-selling author and acclaimed speaker, Don Yeager. Through exclusive conversations with some of the greatest athletes and sports minds of all time, Don identified 16 characteristics that help unlock a person's ability to go from good to great. I'm excited to have him share more of these amazing stories that are sure to inspire, enrich, alter, or in some cases provide clarity in your life. As a benefit to you, please know that the lessons provided in this audio series have enhanced the quality of work in both individual and team environments. It has unlocked the keys to success for many companies worldwide, and I'm confident it can have the same impact for you. Thank you again for taking the time to incorporate this into your listening library. Now I'd like to officially introduce my friend, Don Yeager. But to do so properly, I get to have a little help from great winners like Shaquille O'Neal, Landon Donovan, Michael Orr, Tony Siragusa, Bob Costas, Dick Vitale, and the late, great John Wooden. It is quite the introduction. Let's see if you can pick out the various voices. Enjoy.
You're in for a real treat today.
Your speaker today, Don Yeager, known in the sports world
as one of the most respected and nationally acclaimed writers in our country.
Don Yeager is the author of more than a dozen books,
including 9 New York Times bestsellers.
Don's books, including the one he wrote with me, have sold more than 2 million copies and have been translated into more than a dozen languages.
Don began his career at a newspaper in Texas
and rose to become associate editor of Sports Illustrated magazine, and that's how I met him.
Hey, few people can really experience the kind of exciting resume that Don has had. He's a PCP-er, baby!
In his 25 years as a journalist, Don has worked with some of the greatest champions of our time. Michael Jordan, Mia Hamm, Serena Williams, and me.
He's been a guest on just about every major national television show, from Nightline to Good Morning America to Oprah.
This is Don Yeager, who did that article I was telling you about that's in Sports Illustrated on newsstands now. You should really get it if you're a parent who has a child who's in sports.
He lives with my father, Walter Payton, writing his autobiography while Dad courageously battled cancer.
He even met with the President of the United States in the Oval Office.
Using lessons learned from the world of sports,
Don shares the formulas he's seen and the great winners he's worked with,
and explains how that formula can work for each of us.
As I said, you're in for a real treat.
He's awesome, baby, with a capital A!
Now please welcome my friend.
My friend.
My friend.
Now please welcome my friend, Don Yeager.
Characteristic of greatness number 4, contagious enthusiasm. When I think of greatness and the winners who have shared some of their monumental journey of going from good to great with me, many have shown signs of being courageous, being authentic, taking up personal responsibility, and never giving up. A lot of times, the only way you fail is if you quit. But if there was ever a man whose never-quit attitude turned into a moment of true greatness, it was a man by the name of Tug McGraw. In a keynote speech not too long ago, I spoke about Tug and his ability to allow his own optimism to overpower any situation. May his story crystallize for you the power of positive thinking. It's characteristic of greatness number 4, contagious enthusiasm.
I think of father-son stories, another one that really stands out in my career, a story that I had the chance to tell in a book, but the details of it were always one that really fascinated me. It's a father-son team. Unfortunately, many people in today's generation might only recognize Tim McGraw. But his father, Tug, was a baseball player. Some of you might also remember. They're an amazing story in their own right. See, they didn't even know they were father and son until Tim was 11 years old. Unbelievable story. Tim was actually the product of a one-night stand that Tug had had when he was a AAA baseball player in Jacksonville, Florida. He met a young woman. They were together for an evening, and a few weeks later, the young woman realized that she was pregnant. By that stage, Tug had actually been called up to the major leagues. He was pitching for the New York Mets, and he was pitching quite well, actually, a young rookie player. And the Mets, when they got this phone call that one of their young star players might actually have this additional situation that he needed to deal with, weren't sure exactly how to handle it. And back then, the way teams managed those things was we can all argue the wrongness of it, but they offered the woman. They said, "What do you want? Would you like some amount of money? And would there be some way that you would not really reach out and trouble our player with the way this is happening?" And the woman accepted that money, and she went away for a number of years. And actually, she went on, married somebody else, and she had her son, and his name was Tim, and she raised little Tim Smith in Mississippi, in a household where she married another man. They go on, she and the husband actually have two more children, two daughters. And during that time period, the husband, he struggled with alcohol, had all kinds of challenges going on. And one day at 11 years old, Tim Smith, who was a good little baseball player, came home from baseball practice to find his father and his mother engaged in an altercation. Tim stepped in and the father hit Tim. That night, the mother decided, you know what, it's time for us to leave. We got to get out of here. And so she decides to load her son and two daughters up and leave her husband. As she's doing that, that night she gives Tim a box and tells him to carry it to the car because they're going to escape. And as Tim does so, the lid from the box falls off and he sees his birth certificate for the first time. And Tim Smith realizes that his father, under the line father on his birth certificate, says his father is Frank E. Tug McGraw. Now, Tim was, as I said, a pretty good little baseball player, 11 years old. In fact, he was so good that a lot of teams wanted him, and he played all year long. And Tim Smith had two players. They were his favorite players. Two players whose posters he had on the wall of his bedroom. The first was a player named Cesar Cedeno. Tim will tell you that he chose that player because he just thought it was cool to say the words Cesar Cedeno, right? And how cool would it be to have a name that sounded like Cesar Cedeno? And the second player on Tim's wall was Tug McGraw. How random is that? Tug McGraw, this player who had this boundless enthusiasm for the game of baseball, so infectious was it that not only was his team infected, but players, young players all around the country had Tug McGraw posters on their wall. They loved to see Tug McGraw. So Tim suddenly realizes the man who was the poster on his wall, according to the birth certificate, is his father. How random, how crazy is that? Tim McGraw actually asked his mother if there was a possibility that that's really his father, could they meet? And she reached back out to the Mets, and the Mets arranged that the next time they were playing in Houston, that Tim and his mother would get a chance to meet with Tug. Now, the meeting wasn't that great. Tug said, you know, I'm not really sure I'm your father, but you know what, I want to make sure that we stay in touch, and it's great that you have this enthusiasm, and they did. They stayed in touch for several years, and suddenly at 17 now, Tim's getting ready to graduate from high school. Graduating from high school, and his mother now reaches out and to Tug and says, look, you haven't been very active, and he is your son, and now your son's getting ready to go off for high school, and I think it's time that you step up and maybe do a little bit more. And Tug McGraw says, I'm not really sure, right? I mean, there's nothing concrete that makes this clear that was my little boy. But I tell you what, we're playing again in Houston. He's now with the Philadelphia Phillies. So we're playing in Houston in a couple weeks. I'll be there, and I'll take a paternity test. Let's do that. So they agree to meet. Tug's got his lawyers with him. They're actually there in the hotel lobby, and Tug tells a story. He says he's sitting there. He watches Tim McGraw and his mother walk in through the lobby door, and he immediately looks at his lawyer and says, cancel the test. That's my son. They are spitting images of each other. They look so much alike. They even walk similarly. I mean, it was so obvious that he canceled the test. And Tug McGraw reaches out to Tim and says, you know, Tim, you can hate me for the fact that I haven't been engaged in your life until this point, or you can forgive me and we can move forward. And Tim McGraw, at 17 years old, agreed to forgive and move forward. And that began a relationship. So this father-son story that had a really horrible beginning actually blossomed into something pretty special. And over the course of the next few years, Tim would go off to college, and he would actually quit college and move to Nashville and live in a warehouse where he was going to be a country music star. He was sure of it. And his father was trying to figure out why Tim would ever do that. But Tim sent him a cassette and said, "Listen to my music, Dad." Now, Tug's from Napa, California, where they don't play a lot of country music there, so he didn't have a full appreciation of what Tim McGraw was doing. But it happened that one night, Tug McGraw was at a dinner celebrating the success of his 1980 Phillies team, and one of the people at the dinner, sitting at his table, introduced himself as the CEO of Curb Records in Nashville, Tennessee. Tug said to that CEO, "Would you like a ride back to your hotel?" And on the drive back to the hotel, Tug plugs in Tim's cassette. And the CEO said, "Well, who's this?" And Tug said, "That's my son. He's actually in Nashville trying desperately to get an opportunity to meet with somebody like you." The CEO, so smitten by the fact that he was riding in the car with Tug McGraw, agreed the next morning to let Tim McGraw meet with him. And there began Tim McGraw's career. That was how Tim's career began. In fact, from there on, it obviously went pretty meteoric, right? He would go on to do pretty well and marry Faith Hill, not bad. Over the course of that same time period, Tug's life went the opposite direction. He actually he went through a couple of divorces. Things weren't going very well. And suddenly he's working as a gift that the Philadelphia Phillies had given him, just a little work on the side at a spring training. They were allowing him to work with some relief pitchers when Tug lost control of his faculties. And they rushed him to the hospital. And a doctor takes him in to a room and says, "You know what, Mr. McGraw, you have a brain tumor. It's inoperable. You probably have less than 3 weeks to live." Tug McGraw called Tim. He didn't have anybody else to call. And Tim McGraw, who could have easily had a thorn for the way that the first 17 years of their relationship had begun, Tim McGraw put it all aside, canceled concerts, flew into Clearwater, and took control of his dad's health. And over the course of that time period, they actually went on to spend, Tug lived 10 months, and they got the chance to bond and spend time together like a father and son should. In fact, some of you might remember a couple of years ago, Tim McGraw did a song, it's my favorite actually of his, and I've had the chance to listen to a lot of his music, but he did a song, some of you might remember, this would be that song.
I was in my early 40s with a lot of life before me when a moment came that stopped me on a dime. I spent most of the next days looking at the x-rays, talking about the options and talking about the sweet time. I asked him when it sank in, "This might really be the real end. How's it hit you when you get that kind of news? Man, what you do?" He said, "I went skydiving. I went Rocky Mountain climbing. I went 2.7 seconds on a full main blue mansion."
Next time you listen to that song, hopefully you have a different appreciation for it, because that song was actually a tribute Tim did for his father. At the end of this song, for those of you who might not know this, I had the chance, I worked on a book with Tim and Tug over those last 10 months, had a chance to work with them, and one of the things that really hit me is about the passion Tim had for his father. And it was really amazing, because at the end of this song, if you ever were to watch him perform it live, and on many of the videos, you'll notice that, see, now Tug McGraw was a left-handed pitcher, right? He was a little screwy. But at the end of every strikeout, Tug McGraw tapped his thigh 3 times with his right hand, with his glove, because that was a signal to his family that he was thinking about them, right? So if you ever watch Tim McGraw perform this song, as it gets to the end, when he's in that last little refrain, he always reaches down and hits his thigh 3 times. It's a tribute to Tug and a tribute to the enthusiasm that made Tug his favorite player when he was a young guy. The enthusiasm that allowed him to be such an extraordinary little player that he would end up, an extraordinary player, that he would end up on Tug McGraw's wall long before he ever figured out that they had a relationship. What a powerful lesson this is. We're going to talk about greatness, and we're going to talk about characteristics of it. We've already covered eight of them, and we'll get to those in a minute. But when I look at a characteristic of every true champion, every real extraordinary winner in any line of work, enthusiasm and that power of it, the ability to do what you do with a great desire to be the very best, a passion for it, is an absolute. You know, when you think about this and you think about the way that happened with Tug and where he became quite famous for it, there was a 1973 baseball team that he played for, the New York Mets. And that team was actually loaded. They had some really good talent on the team. And there was a lot of great hope coming into the season. But by the time July 4th, which is kind of a mile marker in Major League Baseball, had rolled around, the team was sitting in last place in its division. Last place. Enormous talent, but they just hadn't quite gelled. The owner of the team actually called a team meeting because he wanted them to get together and he wanted to try to figure out what it was. And the owner was sitting there trying desperately to explain to them the amount of money he was spending on this enormous talent in the room. And obviously the players weren't really going for that. But Tug McGraw, this little pitcher sitting over in the corner, decided that what they really needed was a boost of enthusiasm. So Tug got up right in the middle of the owner's discussion with the players and started going player to player and saying, "You gotta believe. You gotta believe." And his little theme of "you gotta believe" became the team's theme, and every day they walked onto the field saying to each other, "We believe," right? "We believe in each other." And his burst of enthusiasm actually rocketed that team, and by the time the summer was over, actually the New York Mets had risen from last place to first place. It was actually in Major League Baseball history, one of the great late season runs of all time. In fact, they went on to play all the way into the World Series with a team that on July 4th was in last place. A team that on July 4th hadn't even been able to get out of the basement of its own division. Many people in that team and the New York Mets actually have coined that phrase, "you gotta believe." They still hold on to it, though the Mets haven't been very good in a long time. But they coined the idea that you gotta believe. If you're gonna be any good, you gotta believe, right? You gotta have enthusiasm. And I just thought that was so awesome. You know, Tug would go on to win the 1980 championship with the Phillies. He was the pitcher who threw the last pitch in that World Series and got to be tackled by all the players. His enthusiasm for what he did made him so popular that a little 11-year-old boy sitting in Mississippi had his picture on a wall. Wasn't about his talent, wasn't about his size or his beauty. It was that he was a man of great passion. And that enthusiasm is an absolute. If you want to be great, you have to love what you do. You want to be extraordinary, you have to have enthusiasm for every opportunity to work, every opportunity to do what you do.
That's characteristic of greatness number 4, contagious enthusiasm. The power of being a positive thinker can quickly fuel greatness in yourself and in others. Positive thinkers approach situations with an attitude of gratitude. They are thankful for the challenge presented to them, realizing that it merely gives them the chance to enjoy a greater reward. Attitudes are absolutely contagious. So ask yourself, is yours worth catching? What kind of attitude are you spreading to those around you? Be conscious of what you spread through your business or team. It just might be what is preventing you from sustained success. Remember, the study of greatness can be learned from some of the greatest athletes of all time, but it has nothing to do with physical aptitude. It has nothing to do with your ability to touch your toes or jump higher than others. It's about mental, emotional, and spiritual discipline. Developing an edge there through positive thinking and contagious enthusiasm can drive your own greatness in no time. Thank you again for adding this to your listening library. I hope these characteristics have been of value to you. I'd like to steal a phrase from the great UCLA basketball coach, John Wooden. Make each day your masterpiece. Thank you for listening.
Characteristic of greatness number 12, not just about the Benjamins. One of the most overused phrases in America is, money makes the world go round. That may be true, but how fast your world spins can be directly influenced by what you do when faced with critical decisions regarding money. Oftentimes, people associate greatness with a person's accumulation of money. But there can also be greatness in what a person decides to do or not do with money. But let's get down to basics. Merriam-Webster defines money as something, such as coins or bills, generally accepted as a medium of exchange, a measure of value, or a means of payment. Now that's the uniform definition of money, but the nicknames for money get pretty entertaining. People have adopted the more straightforward terms currency, cash, and legal tender. Then we hit the jackpot when our love for slang invited big bucks, moolah, and dough to the money party. I'd be willing to bet that in the last 15 seconds you've either thought about, seen, or heard the word money at least 5 times. Okay, full disclosure. I've said the word money 8 times since we began this lesson, so that was a pretty safe bet. But when it comes to paper money, the $1 bill has ensured the easiest learning curve for memorizing the first president of the United States. George Washington's profile is etched in every single bill, and while Washington is the most common figure in American wallets and pocketbooks, his face on currency doesn't command the same type of attention as that of another American historical pioneer, Benjamin Franklin. The reason is simple. In American currency, 100 Washingtons equals 1 Benjamin. Naturally, the desire to have an abundance of Benjamins far outweighs the desire for $1 bills. But what if I told you greatness can be your good fortune and it has nothing to do with your next big payday? That's true. It's characteristic of greatness number 12. It's not all about the Benjamins. Each year, Forbes puts together its compilation of the highest paid athletes on the planet. And each year, there's a world-class athlete reportedly bringing in $60, $70, $80 million annually. Internationally, soccer and tennis have the premium pay. In the United States, football and basketball have dominated the dollar signs. NBA great Shaquille O'Neal ranks 3rd in NBA history, not in points or block shots, but in career earnings. Shaq made $286 million in salary over the course of his 19-year career. Kobe Bryant made $323 million in his 20 years with the LA Lakers. Both consistently used their talents and success as leverage to maximize their next big multi-million dollar contract. There's nothing wrong with that. But what if I told you that kind of success can still be obtained without the constant demand for maximum salary? San Antonio Spurs legend Tim Duncan stands 7 feet tall and is easily regarded as one of the top 20 ever to play in the NBA. He actually ranks 4th on the list of career earnings, a mere $50 million behind Shaq, after turning in a 20-year career and winning 5 championships. Duncan actually could have been higher on the list, but he started showing what I'll say is an absolute in the study of greatness. He showed that it wasn't all about the Benjamins. He chose team over his own wallet. In 2012, when the norm was to clamor for more money, Duncan did the opposite. He cut his salary in half. The move allowed the Spurs to keep its core group of players together. Had Duncan demanded maximum money, his team would not have been able to re-sign 3 or 4 players that had become benefits to the team in a supporting role. By taking less money, by proving it wasn't all about the Benjamins, Duncan unlocked for himself and his team the ability to win another championship. They went to back-to-back NBA Finals in 2013 and 2014, winning the championship in 2014. In fact, over each of the final 4 seasons of Duncan's career, usually a time when players and agents are seeking that final big contract, Duncan took sizable pay cuts so his team could maintain the cohesiveness necessary to compete at a championship level. It's a rare quality to be able to put your personal financial goals in the back seat so that your teammates can still enjoy the ride to victory. But Duncan's not alone. In fact, one football player has turned in arguably the most prolific NFL career ever, and part of his staying power can be attributed to his willingness to deflate his paychecks in order to fill his team with better supporting talent. Tom Brady of the New England Patriots won 3 Super Bowls in his first 6 seasons as quarterback. He had taken his career from obscurity. Nearly 200 players were picked ahead of him coming out of college, but 150 touchdown passes later, he had become a household name, a name that was in line to get a hefty contract at the end of the 2006 season. He could have broken the bank and demanded maximum salary from the New England Patriots, and justifiably so. Comparisons during that 2007 season viewed Brady as more valuable to the success of the Patriots than practically any other player in the league was to their respective team. But when the comparisons shifted to annual salary, Brady's pay wasn't even in the top 100 of players around the league. When the common process is to take advantage of every opportunity and demand it all, Brady sat down and tapped into his inner greatness. He realized that he couldn't throw the ball and catch it. He needed talent around him in order for the Patriots to be successful. Talent that could not be acquired if he focused solely on taking all of the money potentially available to him. Brady's pay cut during that 2007 offseason freed up space for the Patriots to use the additional revenue and create a team that set NFL records. They signed 3 wide receivers who, with Brady at the reins, connected on 50 touchdown passes and scored more points than any other team in league history. They set every offensive record, but it was because Tom Brady didn't simply say, "I've earned it, I've paid my dues, now pay me." He recognized that there's a finite amount of money in most rooms, and he wanted to make sure the team could afford the best talent available for continuing their championship ways. The Patriots have won 4 Super Bowls now, and Brady has all but cemented his future status in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I actually talked to several of the voters who vote on the Hall of Fame class each year, and they told me there's no question Brady is the first ballot guy. But almost every one of them will tell you that if you want to bring in the reasons to induct Brady, one of the categories is going to be about his ability to look past the payday in the interest of team success. It's a true characteristic of greatness that it's not just about the Benjamins. If you play just for money, if you work just for money, if you chose your profession just for what you're going to earn, if you stay in it just because of all that you might pocket, ultimately, you can be good, but you'll never be great. The truly great ones don't do it just for the money. They appreciate that what they do gives them an opportunity to be involved with something bigger than themselves. In the case of both Tom Brady and Tim Duncan, they continued to play at a high level, but valued the team's ability to play at a high level as a greater goal. This characteristic presents the challenge of what you would do and how you would manage your affairs. Ask yourself, what drives you? What drives the people around you? This is a characteristic that rings true with the younger workforce as well. A recent study of millennials entering the job market showed that money actually ranks 6th on the list of what's important. Topping the list was the ability to do meaningful work, to do or accomplish something that truly matters. If you ask me, that's winning. That's also characteristic number 12. It's not about the Benjamin. Characteristic of greatness number 15, when everyone is watching. It's human nature to want attention. We often crave recognition for the various accomplishments in our life. Between reality TV and social media, every single moment, good or bad, can be documented and viewed by the world. Obviously, that means that mistakes have the potential to be magnified, but it also means that good decisions have just as much of a right to be amplified. Those good decisions, tough as they may sometimes be, are a quick way to unlock your ability to go from good to great. Deciding to do the honest thing when faced with a tough consequence
is an absolute I've learned from the study of greatness. This lesson tees off with a story from the professional golf world. Gone are the days of Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer going by the honor system as they won golf championships and set records. In fact, gone are the days of Tiger Woods' dominance when tournament trophies seemed like they came already etched with Tiger's name on them before the golfers even hit the tee box. Today, everyone is waiting for the next dominant golfer to be both a superstar and a role model. But I will tell you that one of golf's perfect role model moments took place back in 2010 at Hilton Head, South Carolina. The story was overshadowed by the big comeback of Tiger Woods after an unexpected leave of absence from the sport. That year, Tiger returned and played at the Masters in Augusta. While everyone focused on Tiger's infidelity, his lies, and whether he could regain dominance in the sport, another pro golfer by the name of Brian Davis was just focused on winning a tournament. You see, 2 weeks after Tiger's big return, Davis was playing a tour event at Hilton Head, the Heritage Classic. I'm certain many of you have never heard of Brian Davis. In 2010, he was ranked number 74 in the world. He slipped considerably since, but back then, number 74 was pretty good. It still meant you were invisible to most, but it also meant you played some fairly competitive golf on the sport's highest level. Most tournament goers are watching just the players at the top of the rankings, and the crowds follow those golfers at every turn. Being ranked 74th means you're playing a lot of golf with nobody standing behind you, nobody watching and cheering you on. Brian Davis entered that Heritage Classic at Hilton Head, having played a total of 179 professional tournaments. And out of 179 events, he had never finished first. He finished second 5 times, but he'd never won. Imagine trying something 179 times with no real breakthrough. That has to be tough. But he kept plugging away, slowly getting better. This particular tournament was going to be the one. Coming into the final round, final hole of the Heritage Classic, Brian Davis was in contention. He had a chance to win his first ever tournament. Actually, if he birdied the hole, he would tie the leader and get to go into a playoff for a chance to win it all. Brian Davis hit a beautiful approach shot onto the green that nestled about 18 feet from the flag. He walked up to the ball, grabbed his putter and sank the clutch putt for a birdie. He's tied for first place with decorated golfer Jim Furyk. All he needs to do now is score better on the first playoff hole than Furyk, and the trophy would be his. The two golfers go into the playoff hole, and Brian Davis's approach shot was slightly off the green. It had hit a few rocks before settling into a grassy area mixed with twigs and reeds. It was not the ideal placement, but Davis still had a great shot of chipping up onto the green and beating Furyk. His shot was nearly perfect, out of the rough and onto the green for a makeable putt. Maybe this was his chance to win that first tournament. But instead of going to the green to study his putt, Davis stared ahead for a moment, paused, and then walked away to find the nearest marshal or course official. The marshals in golf are the rules guys. These are the people who determine if you've broken the rules or not. The marshal looked puzzled as to why Davis approached him. That's when Brian Davis became a lesson of true greatness. He said to the marshal, "Hey, I know this is on national TV. I know everyone's been watching, and some are even cheering for me to win today, but when I took my golf club back to take that last shot, my club touched a piece of grass, a loose reed that was next to it. And I know that's against the rules in golf. You're not allowed to hit anything other than the ball when you're taking that shot." Brian Davis knew that despite everyone watching him, they still didn't notice his error. The marshal, who didn't notice it, looked stunned. In fact, when they went back and watched it, they needed to see it in slow motion just to see that indeed a small reed had moved ever so slightly as Davis began his backswing. Brian Davis also knew that the rule violation came with a 2-stroke penalty. By calling that foul on himself, Davis once again finished second. After assessing the 2-stroke penalty, Jim Furyk easily had the better score on the final hole, and he won the tournament. The tournament came with a big paycheck,
$1 million to the first place finisher. Second place was $400,000 less. Brian Davis making that decision cost him $400,000. Think about that. Would you call a $400,000 penalty on yourself? There sure were a lot of people wondering the same thing. But here's the moment of greatness. The thing that made Brian Davis a true champion. His decision to do the right thing, even when everybody was watching and cheering him on, he did the right thing. Nobody saw the violation because they were so absorbed in seeing a man who's never won stormed a victory against a seasoned champion. But Davis knew what he'd done was a violation of the rules. I'll be the first to say it. It's a silly rule. Does hitting a piece of grass as you pull your golf club back really give you an advantage over your competition? No, right? But in golf, it's against the rules. Brian Davis knew it, and he called the penalty on himself. He suffered the $400,000 loss. He saw his dream of winning the PGA Tour event ruined by a silly rule. Well, a couple of weeks after that, I drew an assignment to interview Brian. I was assigned to go sit down with him to talk to him about what it was like to make a $400,000 call against yourself. So my question for him was this. I said, Brian, I'm really intrigued. Who is the toughest person you had to explain that decision to? You walk off that green and you had to tell what happened to everybody. Was it your caddy? Because caddies make a percentage of what you earn as prize money, and a loss for Davis meant his caddy wasn't getting part of that $1 million payday either. I asked, was it your wife? Did you have to call and explain that to her? Who was the toughest person you had to explain it to? He said, actually, it was my 5-year-old son. He said he had a son who had seen Brian in the past finish second and come home from a tournament without the trophy. Now, after every tournament Brian plays, he always calls home, and he told me that his son would often get on the line and very simply say the words, Daddy, why didn't you win today? That's got to be a pretty tough question, but it's one a 5-year-old can ask and get away with it, right? So coming into that season, Davis had made a deal with his son. He said, I'm sure that this is our year. This is the year we're going to win a tournament. Somewhere along the way, there's a tournament I'll win, and when that happens, I want you to pick out what you want when we win. Well, his son said he wanted a puppy. He said he wanted a puppy for an entire year. His son said, if you win, I want a puppy. So Brian Davis was telling me the story. He said, on that day, I have to make the call to my son. I call home, and first off, my wife gets on the line, and she said that when I tied the tournament and they saw I was heading to a playoff, she said my son was running around the living room yelling, puppy, 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 puppy. He was sure that the puppy was his. And then Brian Davis had to get on and talk to his son. And his son wanted to understand it. Brian said, you know, you won't get this at age 5, but hopefully you'll understand it at age 25. Some days it's more important to finish second with integrity than to finish first having known you cheated. What a powerful lesson. And out of that, Brian Davis had more people watching him than ever before. Actual schools from all around the United States started writing him letters, considering him a true champion because of the character he showed, and all eyes were on him. Schools from around the world, teachers from all over the world, used his story as an example. His step of integrity helped them explain to their students the importance of being a role model. And as a result, he would start playing in tournaments, and he had a crowd around him. Kids from area schools would follow him along the golf course because they wanted to cheer for the guy who made a difficult decision to call that penalty. Brian Davis was willing to make that decision to do the right thing when everyone was watching. There's an absolute in the study of greatness. We must understand that we are all role models, that we all have standards and ways that we teach. We're not just teaching children, but we're teaching each other. Even the little details that we walk by and manage are the same details that others will ultimately emulate. And our ability to recognize the importance of being a role model is paramount in any pursuit of greatness. Characteristic of greatness number 15, when everyone is watching. This was yet another lesson in this study of the 16 characteristics of greatness. Consistent traits of true champions have been distilled from my lifetime of honest conversations with some of the greatest winners and leaders of our generation. While they all are distinct lessons, they all lead to a couple of common threads of greatness. Simply put, the great ones all at some point acknowledge the desire to be part of, or at least study, great teams. They want to be part of something special, something bigger than just themselves. The great ones know each day is an opportunity to get another step closer to greatness. Thank you again for adding this to your listening library. I hope these characteristics have been of value to you. To close out this part in the What Makes the Great Ones Great audio series, I'd like to steal a phrase from the great UCLA basketball coach, John Wooden. Make each day your masterpiece. Thank you for listening. This is Jerry Blair, and I want to thank you again for making this Greatness audio series a valued part of your personal and professional development. We hope you enjoyed part 6 from Don Yeager, and we look forward to bringing you more absolutes related to the 16 characteristics of greatness and the lessons learned from true champions. Until then, I hope that you are inspired to unlock your own greatness and turn your future with Midland National from good to great. On behalf of all of us at Midland National, thank you for listening.